Hi, and welcome to the Kubernetes podcast from Google. I'm Adam Glick.
And I'm Craig Box. Adam, has being a dad changed your musical tastes?
I would like to say no, but I have found myself finding a lot of very interesting music that I can only call as contemporary kids music, maybe. Yeah, for any of the people that used to listen to Adam and His Package or may have checked out some of the Perry Grip stuff that is online, there's a lot of just fun stuff. The Baby Shark, which was a huge phenomenon, there's a trap mix of that that is quite catchy that we'll put a link to. And my personal favorite that I discovered this past week was Cuckoo Kangaroo, which is a group out of Minneapolis describing themselves as the Beastie Boys meet Sesame Street that just have some really catchy fun stuff.
You're making me feel very out of touch.
What have you been checking out this week?
I went down to the Village Fete and the next village over on the weekend, and they had a fantastic dog show where you'd have a number of different categories that the local people would enter their dogs into. My favorite was the dogs who look like their owner category. There were a bunch of delightful little children dressed up and dogs that were probably not quite as happy as the little children were about being dressed up. But there was one occasion, the winner overall actually was a guy who had a dog called a Pooley, which is a black dog with thick dreadlocks. And the gentleman had long, thick black dreadlocks as well. And I'd say that was clearly the best case of the dog looking like their owner on display. Well worth best in show.
Let's get to the news.
Kubernetes 1.15 snuck out last week to somewhat little fanfare and keeping with the increased maturity of the project. 1.15 is a bit of a snow leopard release, similar to that of last week's Istio 1.2, with continuous improvement explicitly called out as one of two headline features. Enhancements to extensibility, primarily in the custom resource definitions, are the other major set of changes. KubeADM, sometimes pronounced KubeAdam, also has a new logo, with a ship's wheel inside an atom. This further reminds us that Kubernetes users can't tell the difference between the letter T and the letter D, and we can't wait to see how they water down the English language next.
Lyft announced the preview release of Envoy Mobile, a client network library for iOS and Android that brings the power of Envoy to mobile platforms. The library supports key Envoy features like HTTP2, QUIC, and gRPC, as well as configuration via the XDS API. The team is looking to make interactions with the library something entirely abstracted away from application developers by language-specific APIs. Unlike the initial release of Envoy, which was production-ready from its release, Envoy Mobile is described as a proof-of-concept demo, with Lyft's team still working on the features needed to get the library integrated into their clients.
A couple of weeks ago, we reported on a security vulnerability in Docker CP. This week, we have one in kubectl CP, which is actually another path to exploit a vulnerability first disclosed in March. Remember, kids, copying files is hard. New kubectl binaries are available for all the recent releases.
Contena, our guests on episode 31, have announced version 2.4 of their Pharos platform. Of note is that the Contena Lens dashboard, one of Pharos' flagship features, is being split out into a separate project. Lens will be available as a commercial add-on to any conformant Kubernetes cluster later this year.
The CNCF is adding some structure to its ever-expanding stable of projects by introducing CNCF Special Interest Groups, or SIGs. The Technical Oversight Committee this month blessed the concept of SIGs, suggesting there would be 6 or 7 SIGs, and formally starting some, security and storage. Sheesh. SIGs will help assist the TOC by evaluating projects in the area, and are modeled on the similar groupings in the Kubernetes community.
Aqua Security 4.2 is out, bringing with it Aqua Vulnerability Shield, a technology that detects and prevents attacks targeting known vulnerabilities in containers. VShield uses automated vulnerability and component analysis combined with human security research to generate runtime policies that can detect and block access to vulnerable components in containers. It's designed to help you balance the risk of having to take a vulnerable component offline immediately versus leaving it in insecure but usable by blocking access to various resources during runtime.
Citail, guests of episode 45, have released Citail Enterprise 1.0. The product is a broker which connects to identity providers, including those running on-prem, and issues cloud-native identities in the spiffy format to your container workloads. Citail suggests that identity providers are normally only scaled for the static workloads of pre-cloud-native environments, and that their technology will help handle identity in bursty or fast-changing systems.
Diamante has released its 2019 container survey with some predictable results and a few that come out in the rough. It starts with a huge change in who is driving container adoption, with IT jumping up 18% to take the wheel in over 35% of cases, while development is content to take a backseat at about 16.5% of the cases. Of course, this comes with the predictable pain felt by almost 24% of the organizations that responded, finding that a lack of container and Kubernetes knowledge to be a major adoption inhibitor. On-premise continues to be the most common place where people are deploying containers. Databases are increasingly popular, with over 30% of people trying out a database in a container. This was the second most common workload in a container after the somewhat catch-all category of cloud-native applications. Security has moved into a top concern category, edging out IT integration this year. And interestingly, over one-third of companies spending over $100,000 on container software are doing it on bare metal, citing performance as the number one reason, while the number two one is cost avoidance. Hey, hypervisor makers, they're looking at you. Perhaps unsurprisingly, running on bare metal comes with additional challenges, which include management complexity and keeping things up to date, which are topping that list.
Finally, some architecture news from Google. A paper published this week suggests that the overhead in having an in-memory cache on the network, letting your workloads be stateless, is more than that of having the cache in the same process as the application and then having the workloads be stateful. Modern automatic sharding technologies like Slicer from Google or RingPop from Uber can help overcome the perceived downsides of stateful applications, improving overall service performance.
And that's the news. Janos Matias is the co-founder and CTO of Bonsai Cloud. Prior to co-founding Bonsai Cloud, Janos has founded Sequence IQ, a startup which containerized and pushed big data workloads to the cloud and was acquired by Hortonworks in 2015. He's interested in cloud-native distributed systems and loves that Kubernetes superseded the container orchestration platform he'd built in 2014. Janos enjoys free skiing, surfing, and naming his company's products after his favorite surf spots. Welcome to the show, Janos.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start by looking at Bonsai Cloud, the company and the history. What exactly is the company and what problem was it founded to solve?
It's more like an evolution. So we started the company late 2017 in order to make running enterprise application on Kubernetes, purely built on managed Kubernetes by cloud providers. And then at the end, we ended up building a hybrid cloud platform. So basically, it was a long evolution for the company.
The company is based in Hungary?
Yes. So we are in Hungary, Budapest.
What's the tech market like in Budapest?
It's pretty good. There is lots of talent, lots of universities. So we have access to good engineers and a bunch of big companies are over there, like IBM, Hortonworks, Cloudera.
And their primary product is Pipeline. Tell us about Pipeline.
The purpose why we built Pipeline was to speed up development of applications, basically to allow developers to go from commit to scale on Kubernetes on these cloud providers we support or manage Kubernetes. It provisions Kubernetes clusters on-premise in cloud, either running our own distribution or running on top of managed Kubernetes distributions. And then basically it gives out-of-the-box logging, monitoring, auto-scaling, security for all these applications.
So this seems a little different than some of the other things that I've seen in the space, in particular that you're managing essentially other managed Kubernetes offerings. What made you decide to look at managed Kubernetes offerings versus going bare metal or straight with your own distribution?
Initially, our idea was that we cannot build Kubernetes and we don't understand the cloud better than those who have built their own cloud. So basically, it's like, you know, we always used to use GKE and we had an idea that GKE is great, you know, it provisions Kubernetes fast. It gives basically everything you need when you are about to do Kubernetes, but, you know, it doesn't go fair high enough in the stack. And what I mean under that is that, you know, like prior founding this company, we've been running big data workloads in containers. And, you know, we had the idea that we should run Spark, TensorFlow, Kafka, all these big data workloads on Kubernetes, you know, automate the whole provisioning and automate the whole monitoring of these things. And also adding Node.js, Spring Framework, Java, and other applications. So, yeah, going back to the original question, we supported this cloud provider managed Kubernetes, but at the end now we ended up making our own Kubernetes version, mostly running on-prem.
Is Kubernetes the thing that your customers want, or are they looking for the platform to run Node.js or Ruby or something?
We are basically two types of customers at high level. So we have the SaaS companies who are running applications in the cloud, and they don't really care about Kubernetes for them. The most important thing is that they can run their own applications fast and easy, and they can deploy it on these managed Kubernetes offerings or our Kubernetes version. And they get out of the box monitoring, logging, centralized security, and all these things. So these guys, they don't really care. Basically, the whole Kubernetes stuff, it's abstracted. It's abstracted behind an API, a CLI, and the UI, and often they don't even interact with Kubernetes. They interact with the pipeline platform, Obviously, underneath Kubernetes, and all the building blocks are built on CNCF components, but these companies, they don't really care what they run. They like Kubernetes because of the flexibility it gives for them. Obviously, they like being able to run in the cloud. So these guys, they don't really care about Kubernetes. And at the end of the spectrum, we have the enterprise customers where, you know, like they make a decision and they made a bet that Kubernetes actually is the stack they want to run their own applications. And a cloud provider, or they make a decision on a certain distribution. And then basically they want to deploy, go through the same things like the SaaS providers. They want to deploy their own applications, but often they want to build internal as a service offerings on top of Kubernetes. So for them, it's a bit different than for smaller SaaS providers.
You provide some optimization tools with your platform. What do those optimization tools do for each of your customers?
Yeah, we have multiple tools. As I said, this was a long journey for us. And along this way, we have built a couple of open source components, which allowed us to optimize usage and cost for our customers, even when we were running purely on managed Kubernetes. So we have a system called CloudInfo, where basically we track services and costs from cloud providers. So it's a unified way to track these prices and available instance types services across five providers through a unified interface, API, CLI, and UI. So this is one thing which we offer our customers. Basically, they can choose either the cheapest cloud, or they can choose, using this system, they can select cloud providers, for example, where TPUs are available when they are running TensorFlow. And then we have another system which is open source again, called Telescopes, which basically abstracted the whole resource management. So Telescopes basically allow users to claim resources. So for example, they can say, I need 48 virtual CPUs and X amount of memory, and probably I want TPUs or high availability network. And then basically they submit into the system, and the system turns these things into an infrastructure recommendation for a particular cloud provider.
So with your Telescopes tool, you're able to help people make choices automatically about where to add or remove nodes from their clusters?
By default, yes, but obviously they can override those choices.
Do you find that people are willing to move only between regions, or will people actually move to a different cloud in order to run a workload cheaper?
I think multi-cloud is happening, so it's a real use case. Not in the sense that, so most of our customers are still running on a single cloud. However, they want the option to be able to move either for regulation for other purposes to a different cloud. So basically, they want to keep the door open if they need to move from this cloud provider to the other cloud provider. So in a sense, yes.
So you're doing billing, letting people know kind of what their bill will be by looking at the prices. You're also making recommendations of what they might want to do in order to optimize that. Does it take the next step as well of deploying to that? If someone says, I always want to be running on the lowest cost, to move those workloads around for them?
Yes, there is one minor note. So we don't do billing. So basically the customer is running within their own account.
Mm-hmm.
So they bring their own Google credential, for example. We just recommend instance types for them, or we just recommend cluster layouts.
Are you also taking a look at proactively doing, if they say, I always want to be running on the lowest cost, for instance, will it proactively move them between instance types, regions, or geographies, on-prem, cloud, in order to be able to optimize the cost? Or does it make the recommendation and then the operations team has to decide, okay, go do that?
So we don't do automatic migration of workloads. So basically, if someone would like to do that, it's available. So we have our own custom scheduler, and we track prices and we track services across cloud providers. But by default, we don't move workloads. So basically, we operate these clusters for the users, but we don't move their workloads. There is only one way when we move their workloads, but that happens within cloud provider from instance to instance, where they are running, for example, on preemptible instances, and those instances are claimed back by the cloud provider. In that case, we have a custom scheduler which drains the nodes and then behind the scene brings back probably different instance types and basically move the workloads from the claimed back instances into the new ones, but not across cloud providers yet.
Pricing tends to be relatively static and change on, you know, months or several months. Are you also taking a look at things like preemptibles and spot markets that are much more dynamic in price?
Yeah, so in case of Google, obviously it's much more simpler than in case of AWS, where prices fluctuates. However, so we track prices. We have a price history probably back now. Seriously, we've been live late November, I guess. So we have price information across all the spot markets and instance types. But what we have noticed, either in case of Google or AWS, we haven't done that for Microsoft yet. we have noticed that basically the instance size is being taken away. It's not because of price, but it's because of capacity.
Do you happen to remember if there's any occasion where like one zone has always got capacity and runs cheaper, or does the market mostly work as it's meant to?
I guess the market works as it meant to. However, we noticed, you know, for us it's 6 p.m., 9 a.m. in the U.S., so we noticed these spikes when U.S. West Coast wakes up.
Now, you mentioned that you predominantly run on the managed infrastructure services like GKE that are provided by the cloud providers, but you've also blogged recently about some cases where those services didn't provide what you need and you've actually used your own deployment system to manage Kubernetes services that you run for your pipeline customers on those environments. Why was that?
We never meant to build our own Kubernetes distribution. However, we ended up doing one. So obviously, managed Kubernetes differs from cloud provider to cloud provider. So we have been always perfectly happy with what Google offers with GKE, for example, and we have not built a managed Kubernetes version for Google, for instance. We have one for AWS and we have one for Microsoft. And the main reason where we have built that is because we need access either to new features, where usually, for example, on GKE, it's available through feature flex, or we need access to API servers. And, you know, there are many things like why people would love to have access to API servers. Probably they use a different authentication, you know, authentication and authorization model. We use Dex, for example, in our case behind the scene, and we have a system which turns JVT tokens into RBAC rules. So this, you know, especially happens with bigger enterprises. They are not really happy integrating, you know, their security model into the cloud provider security model. So they need something where, you know, they can plug their own stuff. That's one thing. The other thing is, you know, it's minor things like speed, you know. So there are some cloud providers where their managed Kubernetes offering is painfully slow, you know. And there we have people who are running CI systems on Kubernetes. And, you know, it's for them, it's not acceptable if something comes up in, say, 5 minutes instead of 50 minutes, you know. So
you've also started to build things that are both hybrid and multi-cloud, both running on-prem, on people's own hypervisors, and then on other clouds. What kind of inspired that decision to spread out that way?
Multi-cloud for us was, even since last year, summer, for us, multi-cloud was a reality. So it means reality in the sense that we've been able to deploy deployments across these five managed Kubernetes providers. So we had a concept called a cluster group, where we've been able to group Kubernetes clusters into a group.
It's a good name.
And and basically do deployments across these cluster groups with overrides. So for example, if somebody was pushing out a deployment into Google or AWS, it was able to push, you know, a different configuration for Google or the other cloud provider, and they could override their configs. The same, and we'll be managing, you know, the lifecycle of these deployments. It was a very simple lifecycle management. It still is, you know, we manage updates, deletes, and basically deployments. So this is the multi-cluster stuff where, you know, it's people, they don't really care about those applications. They don't really interact with each other. Their primary goal is that they have an application and they need to distribute across multiple cloud providers. So for example, they need to publish to a geographic region where one of the providers, for example, they don't have access or they don't have a data center.
Do you expose the differences to someone? Are you saying, here's a single control plane, like the old federation model where you deploy to that control plane and then it abstracts them away? Or do you have a model where the user sees, I have one on premises in Budapest and I have three in cloud on Google and one on Microsoft, for example?
It's abstracted, but at the same time, it's available for them to see, you know, what they have and where they have. Actually, we have things like when somebody comes to our control plane and sets up these multi-cluster groups, for instance, they are able to set up include and exclude lists, and they can add data centers or they can remove data centers. They can add VM flavors, for example, or they can remove. They say, okay, we are not allowed for this particular group to spin up clusters where they have TPUs, for example, because it costs us a lot. So for training, they can go just with regular compute clusters. So we have this include exclude list.
Now, some other open source components that you've developed as part of this platform and made available to the community. What are bank vaults?
So basically, bank vaults, it's a vault operator at a very high level. So, you know, we've been using pre-order to Red Hat acquisition of CoreOS. We've been using the vault operator quite a lot. So basically, with all the secrets, for example, cloud provider credentials, access to different systems, Grafana dashboards, everything we've been storing in vault. Obviously, that project has been discontinued. So basically, we set up a new vault operator, and also it's a CLI tool which initializes vault on Series Vault. So we've been adding lots of features to operate Vault properly on Kubernetes. And then we've been pretty much, obviously in case of cloud provider, it's, you know, you got a certain level of security from a provider that, you know, your secrets, we don't know whether, for example, it's using an etcd or it's a shared etcd or wherever secrets are stored, but, you know, we wanted to avoid secrets being landed on etcd, for example. So Kubernetes secrets for us was something which we wanted to avoid. So this bank would be side operating Vault. It's now it's able to inject secrets directly into pods at the time when it's needed. And then basically it's removed from the process. So it injects directly straight into the pod. It never ends up on etcd or any other means.
You mentioned that you built a bank vault operator, as well as I think you've been working on some other operators. What made you decide to use the operator model of deployment versus other things like, you know, CRDs or Helm?
We've been doing lots of operational code. So I like to say that operators somehow are, you know, like it's human operational knowledge embedded in code. So we've been doing this since, you know, like we had the option from Kubernetes with CRDs, you know, and then we've been involved with the CoreOS guys in the operator SDK. I guess that was back in 2017, if I remember correct. So we've been, even before the operator SDKs, we've been involved into that. And, you know, we like the concept. So all our code, which was managing, you know, bits and that, we've been now moving into operators. And we open source quite a lot of operators. So we have a logging operator, for example, which configures Fluentd, Fluentbit, you know, automatically and basically move your logs for all pods into centralized location, a bucket, for example, or Elasticsearch. We have this bank vault operator, which operates Vault. We have a Kafka operator, which we recently open sourced. And then probably there are a bunch of others.
Well, let's talk about the Istio operator, which you released recently.
We've been using Istio, I guess, since version 0.8. And the first time when, you know, the multi-cloud, the multi-cluster stuff showed up, it was very premature, but we loved, you know, what Istio offers. And I was talking with Adam before the show that, you know, we really like this Istio, you know, like the Istio stuff. Istio has been released or open sourced by, you know, companies, and basically it leveled the whole playing field for us. And we were able to build pretty cool things on top of this. So we've been using Istio for a while. We've been deploying Istio with Helm. We had actually no problem deploying Istio with Helm. But as we were going into multi-cloud scenarios, then basically it was, we started to make some templating in order to create multi-mesh clusters. And operating these clusters was starting to take up lots of time from us. So we decided, obviously we went and checked what's available and what's not available. And there were not really other Istio operators available at that time. But there was a huge interest from the community to build an Istio operator. So basically, we decided to go ahead and build an Istio operator because we needed not just to install Istio across these hybrid environments, but actually we needed to operate and obviously do upgrades.
And Louis Ryan mentioned to us last week, the Istio project is going to ship its own operator. Is that built on your work?
Partially. So right after we released the Istio operator 3-4 months ago, I can't really remember, late winter, basically we got in contact with a couple of folks from Google. So Martin Ostrowski basically contacted us and he proposed to do this work together in the community. And we were really happy moving ahead with that. So for us, you know, like we use Istio, great open source product. We have built our own Istio operator. But for us, you know, operating Istio, it's not the end product for us. The end product, it's basically it's built, operating hybrid clouds is built on pipeline. So we didn't want it to have our own Istio operator, and probably the industry would come up or the open source community would come up with a different Istio operator. And, you know, it's tested and backed by all these companies like Google, for example. So yeah, we are pretty pleased that we are part of this initiative. So currently Google, Red Hat, and ourselves are working on this Istio operator, the official one. So ideally our goal is to move all the features which we have in the current version of our Istio operator into the official Istio operator and basically have the let the community pick up from there. You know, obviously we are dedicated to support this and work on this.
Do you think that will hold true for, say, the Kafka and Fluentd communities? Do you think that soon there will be a single operator provided by that community or the vendor who makes the product?
For Kafka?
For any of them. Do you think it will become something that each open source project has to offer in order to have their workload run on Kubernetes?
Yeah, ideally, yes. We, in case of Istio operator, obviously, we've been lucky, you know, that Google has seen value in this, you know, and basically it's willing to work on us in the open source to continue this project. You mentioned Kafka. So for example, in Kafka, I'm not sure. Ideally, I would love to have one Kafka operator. There are like two or three Kafka operators out there yet. So the reason why we were not working on any of them is like, first we have a thing with Go. So for example, the Streamz operator is built on Java. So I ended up doing Java work a few years ago.
I'm sorry for that.
Yes. The Confluent operator, we don't know too much about that. You know, I guess it's closed source. But with Kafka, I would like to have one Kafka operator, but conceptually we do a totally different thing. And what I mean under that is that, you know, we have a huge experience operating Kafka, for example, and also we know Kubernetes quite a lot. And I believe the current Kafka operators out there are not really the best way to run Kafka on Kubernetes. Basically, they are all built on stateful sets, and we believe that it's not the right way moving ahead with that.
What is the right way?
Think lower level building blocks like pods, CRs.
Okay.
We love stateful sets, and obviously, you know, it's a great concept, but, you know, the worst thing which we don't like about stateful set is ordering. So, for example, in case of Kafka brokers, we wanted to have fine-grained configuration, broker-by-broker configuration, and also if you wanted to remove a broker for maintenance or whatever, let's say from the middle of the cluster, you can't really do that with the stateful sets. You have to remove all the brokers down to that particular number, you know, because that's how stateful set works.
So you almost need like a Kafka stateful set or something like that describes the relationship between these things that's an extension to that.
Exactly. And this is the nice thing about Envoy, that Envoy allows you to do these protocol filters, for example, and there is one going to build for Kafka.
At KubeCon, you made a number of announcements. What were they?
I think the most important announcement is the service mesh on pipeline. So basically, obviously, we have the multi-cloud support and we have the hybrid cloud support. So what we are doing, what we have announced actually, it's a unified control plane which runs on these multiple cloud providers, and it's able to create service meshes across either multiple cloud providers or on-premise and cloud.
And what will that enable for your customers? What are the benefits of them running a multi-cloud service mesh?
Yeah, the good thing is we've been working on this for a while, and Google came up with, announced Google Anthos a month or 2 months ago. And it was pretty, first of all, it was very nice for us that basically it said, okay, now it assured us that we are towards the right direction, you know, because if something probably, at least myself personally, I believe Google is doing it, it probably is good for the industry. So that's one thing. The other thing is what it brings for our customers is basically it's able to scale out from on-premise into these multiple cloud providers. So we have a case study where, for example, we have a customer who's been running mostly on AWS and on-premise. And for, you know, they track lots of data, on, they store lots of data on Google Cloud, and they started to build services and moving into Google Cloud, GKE. So they build all those services on GKE, and now they want it to put into a mesh. So this gives us the option to basically wire these services into a common mesh running across on-prem and two cloud providers.
The name Banzai Cloud, where does that come from?
Banzai Cloud, it's basically, initially when we started the product, as I said, the company wanted to build something similar like OpenShift, pretty simple enterprise application platform built running on managed Kubernetes. And we believe that, okay, this is going to be a pipeline which allows developers to go from commit into production. So yeah, since we've been thinking that this is a pipeline, you know, I like naming my companies or my projects after surfing spots. So I was thinking, okay, well, there is a famous spot on North Shore to Oahu called Banzai Pipeline. So let's name the product Banzai Pipeline. But, you know, it was quite long. So basically, we ended up naming the product Pipeline, the Pipeline platform, and naming the company Banzai Cloud. Naming things is pretty hard. So, you know, it's...
Do people ever confuse you with the art of small trees, the Japanese art of bonsai?
No, not really.
What would you name your next company or product?
Oh, I don't want to be the next company. I'm perfectly happy here. So I did mention a couple of products, telescopes, holotrees, pipelines. So these are all source spots, either in Oahu or Mantua, Indonesia.
There's telescopes. I assumed it was just telescoping something. There's a surf spot called telescopes.
Yeah, so I like to, you know, like when we start a new project and we know what it's doing, then I'm in a hunt, you know, to find a surf spot for the product, which is, you know, somehow resembles what the stuff is doing. So we have...
Probably easier than finding an ancient Greek word, which is what everyone else tries to do.
Yes. When we were about to do the company, we came up, we wanted to came up with something similar, you know, but we are not really good on Greek mythology and Greek names. So we ended up...
That's a Banzai Cloud with zero Ks.
I like it because it's got an N and a Z in it.
Yeah. And the product doesn't have a K.
What's next for Banzai Cloud? What's on the roadmap?
Good question. As I said, we launched this service mesh stuff. Obviously, we are doing some other projects. couple of other operators for big data. So basically, we have Spark, TensorFlow, Kafka, and Zeppelin running. So we want to productize this, build somehow a platform out of this, you know, for operating big data workloads in the cloud. We also have some other application stacks, Node.js, Spring. So basically, we are working on those things. But the main direction for us at this point is investing into this hybrid cloud stuff.
All right, Yanis, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
You can find Yanis on Twitter at @matyix_. How would you pronounce that?
Matyix.
Is it a Hungarian word?
Yeah, it's my nickname, you know, from my family name. It's strange Hungarian names.
Thank you for listening. As always, if you've enjoyed this show, please help us spread the word and tell a friend. If you have any feedback for us, you can find us on Twitter at KubernetesPod or reach us by email at KubernetesPodcast@google.com.
You can also check out our website at KubernetesPodcast.com to find show notes and transcripts. Until next time, take care.
Catch you next week.